You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
One of the moons of Saturn is a base for UFOs, you see.
And at the same time, we can see Africa.
We're created in the hearts of distant stars.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, an artist who believes we're sending the wrong messages out to extraterrestrials.
We sent pictures of man and Barbie doll into space. We sent pictures of advertently or inadvertently of our own intolerance.
We'll look at how the ancient Greeks' model of the universe still shapes music.
It's looking for some kind of divine proportion and, in the deep sense of the word, harmony.
My guest today is Annie Drian, the science philosopher and, with her late husband Carl Sagan, a co-creator of the film Contact. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. For a project I'm working on, I've been spending a lot of time lately reading and thinking about culture in the middle of the 19th century. It was the time when the brand new music by Felix Mendelssohn and Frédéric Chopin was wildly popular. And when middle-class audiences in Paris and London and New York were eager to come out and hear the radically new music of the wild German Richard Wagner. Trying to imagine life in that era of relentless, exhilarating newness, I got to wondering why it is today, in the early 21st century, that mainstream musical tastes are still stuck so completely back then, in the 19th century. Not that there's anything wrong with listening to Wagner or Chopin or even Mendelssohn, but it is strange, isn't it, that an absolute majority of the music performed by all the American symphony orchestras this season will be by just four guys. Four guys who were all composing music during the same 100-year period that ended more than 100 years ago. Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, and Tchaikovsky. Who are our Brahmses and Tchaikovskys, the historically important composers of this time? Why don't we know their music? Why don't we even know their names? Of the top five living American classical composers, I confess that I own a CD by only one of them. John Adams, who is the most performed living composer, according to a new survey by the American Symphony Orchestra League. But of the rest of the top five, I recognize the name of only one, John Corigliano, but had never heard of Christopher Rouse, Joseph Schwantner, or Aaron J. Kernis. 150 years ago, the 1852 version of me would have known all about Mendelssohn and Chopin and Wagner and a dozen other famous composers of the time. Back in that supposedly conservative Victorian era, older music from the 18th and the 17th centuries was almost never performed. Audiences then expected their symphonic music to provide novelty and surprise. But today, most people who like classical music have simply stopped looking to it for anything new or unfamiliar or unexpected. They may read only the freshest contemporary fiction and rush to cutting-edge independent films, but music? From classical music, we want only reassurance and nostalgia. Mainly, I think, it's because we tend to think that all contemporary orchestral music is going to be harsh and difficult, perverse, atonal, medicinal, random squawks and clicks. But if we assume we'll hate anything more modern than Stravinsky, we're cutting ourselves off from culture, turning ourselves into old fogies prematurely. I mean, just listen for a minute to a little music by our top living composers. Corigliano's Voyage for Flute and String Orchestra. Musica Celestis by Aaron J. Kernis. And finally, Christopher Rouse's Concert de Gaudi. Not harsh, not difficult, not perverse, simply new. And worth discovering for the sheer pleasure new music can provide. And because if we all close our ears to new work, as we began doing in the middle of the last century, I'm betting that by the end of this new century, our classical music tradition will be dead. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Martha Stewart and Ralph Lauren and Michael Graves are household names in every sense, and these days it's hard to avoid owning an item branded with the name of some well-known designer or arbiter of taste. In Design for the Real World this week, Studio 360's Julie Burstein visits a new exhibit of work by the couple who probably invented this way of selling housewares, Russell and Mary Wright.
When I walked into the entry gallery of the Wright exhibition, it was like walking into my parents' dining room. Well, maybe not exactly. I didn't live in a grand mansion on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I grew up in a 1950s split level. But as I climbed the stairs at the Cooper Hewitt, I could hear the low, happy murmur of a party piped in on speakers. And the first thing I saw were my parents' dinner plates, simple white stoneware with a rich charcoal black glaze, incised in the center with a delicate tangle of white clover leaves, flowers, and stems. I can still remember how, as a kid, I loved to hold those plates, the smoothness and the weight in my hand, and the little indentations of the flower design under my fingers.
They're comfortable. They feel solid and weighty.
Donald Albrecht is one of the curators of this exhibit.
I think also the curved edges, especially in the bowls, is a very comfortable, warm. You know, they're comfortable to the touch, and they feel solid and like, you know, warm kumquats.
My mom's plates are the first on a 40-foot table in the center of the exhibition. It's covered with Wright's many dinnerware designs, most with monochromatic, rich, deep glazes, as well as his modern glassware and his sinuous pinch flatware.
We decided to center the exhibition on a table because in his own thinking and in his own career, the table was always the sort of the emotional heart of his thinking about how to revolutionize the home.
In 1939, Wright introduced his American modern dinnerware. In contrast to formal dinnerware with ornate decoration on wide rims, Wright made simple rimless plates, curvy celery trays, and other pieces in sensuous organic shapes. They were modern, streamlined, but each curve had a purpose.
If you looked at the American modern salt and pepper shaker, there's a natural indentation for holding it. And the most extreme version of that is this, what was called the hostess plate, where ridges define the space for the different kinds of foods. There's also a point where you can put your thumb, and there's even a little round area, a crater, where you can put a cup. And that was created to make it possible to have a sort of a stand-up cocktail party dinner.
There were lines outside the department stores at opening time, and newspapers reported fracases among customers trying to restock their cupboards with American Modern.
Robert Schoenfeld is the co-curator of Russell Wright American Lifestyle. He says people fell in love with the beautiful quality of Wright's glazes.
He always gave the colors names. Here we're looking at seafoam green, a chartreuse. They also called this a seedless grape or curry color. The cup and saucer are called granite gray.
Granite gray is the color that Martha Stewart now collects. And those names, which sound like something you might see in her paint collection, or in just about any clothes catalog that comes in the mail. Those names were just one of Mary Wright's marketing innovations that helped her husband's designs fly off the shelves.
It was a kind of holistic marketing campaign that started with furniture, went to dinnerware, tablecloths, silverware, etc. And it went across department. It was branded, in other words, as we'd say today, from department to department, all under the name Russell Wright. So he was really the first personality designer that the public knew.
The Wrights viewed themselves as providers of the implements for this new lifestyle that was being structured by the growth of suburbs, especially after the war.
Well, he was writing scripts for people to live ideal lifestyles.
In 1950, Russell and Mary Wright published their manifesto on how to live a modern, social, suburban life. Guide to Easier Living became a bestseller and offered detailed instructions for informal living. The Wrights titled one chapter The Scientific Housewife and included a chart of how to make a bed in just 30 easy steps.
Step ahead of side A, pull tuck a half of head, miter and tuck head half of side A, lower sheet.
Each corner. And another chapter presented meticulous directions on how to set up a simple family dinner, cafeteria style. Plates and serving dishes are to be set on the table in a T-shape, silverware and plates along the short end, serving dishes with the main course, salad, and dessert down the center of the table. This turned dinner into an assembly line.
What's ironic about a lot of these easier systems is after describing it in the book, then there's an instruction from the Wrights that say, please understand, this takes tremendous and careful advanced planning. So you wonder how spontaneous and easy it really was. These are also two people who talked about suburbia but had a townhouse in Manhattan and a country estate in Garrison. So
they were creating a life that they didn't necessarily live. No,
that's right, yes. But genuinely, I think, did believe that it was good for people.
In their Guide to Easier Living, Russell and Mary Wright say that good informal living substitutes a little headwork for a lot of legwork. It doesn't need wealth, but it does take thought, some ingenuity and resourcefulness, and more than a little loving care to create a home that is really your own. Or maybe just the home you're supposed to have. In Studio 360, I'm Julie Burstein.
Russell Wright, American Lifestyle, is on exhibit in New York City at the National Design Museum at the Cooper Hewitt until March 20th. To see some images of Wright's designs, you can visit our website at studio360.org.
Beautiful view of Florida now. We can see the Cape just the point.
Roger.
And at the same time, we can see Africa.
What window are you looking out of?
I can see the entire Earth now out of the center window. I can see Florida, Cuba, Central America, the whole northern half of Central America, in fact, all the way down through Argentina and down through Chile.
Hey, you picked a good day for it.
That's the crew of Apollo 8, seeing the Earth from their window after orbiting the moon for the first time in 1968. And it still gives me goosebumps. From an early age, I was always happy to let my imagination drift and careen through space. At the time, that was easy. The first satellites went up when I was 3. John Glenn orbited the Earth when I was 7. Human beings stepped onto the moon for the first time when I was 14. I read Tom Swift and I watched Star Trek, and then graduated to 2001 A Space Odyssey and the novels of Ray Bradbury and Philip K. Dick. These days, I subscribe to Scientific American mainly to be wowed by the articles about astronomy and cosmology. And the closest I come to a regular spiritual practice is staring into the sky on clear nights. Space is, as the kids say, awesome. And for the last half millennium or so, all kinds of artists have used space as inspiration to awe and to be awed. And in turn, our real 21st century world, the actual rockets and space shuttles and space stations and extraterrestrial research projects, have been inspired and shaped by the visions of artists and storytellers. My guest today is Ann Dreehan, who has written and produced TV programs about space and conceived the film Contact in collaboration with her husband, the late Carl Sagan. She's also the former secretary of the Federation of American Scientists and now runs Cosmos Studios, a company she set up to create science-based entertainment. Annie Dreehan, welcome to Studio 360.
My pleasure.
What got you interested in space?
Actually, I remember the moment that I heard that the Russians had launched the Sputnik into space, the very first object created by humans, lofted into space. I was 8 years old. It was on the radio. And that was, of course, 1957. And it was an epiphanal moment for me because it was the first time I realized you could actually get off the planet. And, of course, I grew up in Queens, so I took the requisite trips to the Hayden Planetarium, and I weighed myself on Mars. And that was another breakthrough because it suddenly occurred to me that your weight was not a constant, that it had to do with the world that you lived on. And a series of kind of mind-opening experiences. And then I had the great good fortune to meet Carl Sagan. And Carl opened the universe for me, as he did for many hundreds of millions of people worldwide.
Or billions and billions,
and billions, I guess. And billions. I was hesitated to say that.
It's interesting that you mentioned this idea, and I remember it being striking to me as a child as well, of objects and people's weights theoretically being different on different planets, because it does give you a sense of the relativism of all of our perspectives, doesn't it, in a kind of really fundamental way.
That's what science does. And that's why I love science, is it's constantly kicking us in the teeth that way and saying we're much smaller and much less central than we'd like to think we are. And it's these series of demotions that science has given us that I think it is the reason for the great social and political trauma that we're living through right now, the kind of tension between what we know scientifically and what we want to believe.
And that's sort of been going on for a couple of hundred years.
It's been a hell of a couple of hundred years.
Why did you start Cosmos Studios?
Well, I was struck by how gifted we are as a species, as a civilization, in terms of our abilities to simulate reality on a grand scale. We have these gorgeous special effects, but we only use them mostly to blow things up. We rarely use them to convey to the widest possible public the grandeur of the universe or what science is telling us. And I was really struck by this after Carl Sagan died and in the aftermath of the work we'd done together. I wondered how it would be possible to continue this work. It didn't seem that there was anyone who had come to occupy the ecological niche that Carl had left behind.
And ecological meaning in the ecology of...
Meaning a voice of science.
Ideas.
That was poetic, that was ethical, that was filled with passion, but also good, solid, hard information. Both skepticism and wonder in equal amounts, full tilt.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with Annie Dreehan, the writer and producer. In a minute, we'll meet an artist who's trying to revise what we've sent out beyond the solar system. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. We're talking today about space, and with me for that conversation is Annie Dreehan, who served as creative director for the NASA Voyager Interstellar Record Project, which some years ago launched a collection of music and images into space. theoretically to help introduce humans and Earth to alien civilizations. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are now almost 8 and 6 billion miles away and counting. Our first story deals with that project. Or rather, it deals with an artist who believes he could have done part of it better. And he's even trying to do it better himself right now. Studio 360's Lou Okowski has a look at the work of Joe Davis.
Joe Davis's ideas involve E. coli, electron guns, DNA, and beat-up pieces of satellite recovered from space. By the sound of that toolkit, you might think we're about to talk with a biologist, or maybe an astrophysicist.
I have no classical credentials in science whatsoever. I have never, I took biology in junior college. I'm not a scientist, I'm an artist, very clearly, although there's a lot of argument about that, too.
And when Joe Davis starts telling you about his work, it's easy to see how he causes argument. Like with one of his more ambitious projects, Poetica Vaginale.
It was a project to transmit vaginal contractions into space to communicate with aliens. But it wasn't really about transmitting vaginal contractions into space to communicate with aliens. It was about transmitting vaginal contractions into space to communicate with ourselves.
Joe arrived at MIT one day almost 20 years ago, unannounced, and demanded that someone listen to him. MIT set him up with lab space that same day. Joe's ideas are kind of like that. They come barreling out of nowhere with great sense of purpose. Poetica Vaginale makes fun of our first serious scientific attempts to communicate with aliens. In the 1970s, we launched the Pioneer and Voyager spacecrafts into outer space. We included drawings of man and woman, what NASA called the average person from our civilization. But we left something out.
We removed external female genitalia from, just like the artists of the classical age removed the external female genitalia from all the likenesses of we created of ourselves. It's the part we left out of the messages we sent to extraterrestrials before. And now we wonder why aliens come down here and abduct us to experiment with our sex organs. We sent pictures of man and Barbie doll into space. We sent pictures of advertently or inadvertently of our own intolerance.
Something had to be done. Joe knew he couldn't just launch another spaceship with a more accurate picture, but he thought he could do the next best thing. So we worked out this project to transmit the sound of vaginal contractions into deep space. Joe inspired a team of 40 artists and scientists to help set the record straight. Medical doctors from Harvard, electrical engineers, biologists, and linguists from MIT, and classically trained ballet dancers. They recorded the vaginal contractions of the dancers and translated them into the 46 phonemes of English speech. And what they beamed by radar to four nearby sun-like stars was a combination of the original data in digital form and this creative representation of the contractions as human speech, what Joe calls poetry. And in a way, Joe's already made contact with an alien species. He invented a microscopic fishing hook to catch live, single-celled paramecium. You can feel them pull on the line like a giant marlin. Joe's made those invisible creatures not only visible to us, but tangible and audible.
Here's a lot of paramecia. I really don't have any delusion that aliens are going to land and go, hey, we got your message. But it's a perfect lens for looking back at ourselves. It's a mirror. There's a kind of poetic about that.
Joe's art directs our gaze to something we either can't or won't see. It's almost always something completely absurd, and he uses the rigor of advanced science to make us look, to unsettle us.
It's about sort of like revealing, like taking away the sort of stiff tuxedo of scientific endeavor and just recognize what we've done and that we maybe might have made a mistake.
And while Joe's been looking into space, he spied something so completely obvious that it's amazing the rest of us missed it.
But see, we've been flushing our toilet in space now for 20 or 30 years. The space shuttle flushes its toilet in space. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and Skylab, they all flush their toilets into space.
Joe believes that a wide belt of this stuff surrounds the Earth and that it's heading deeper and deeper into space. So it's possible that the first thing aliens find of us will be the very thing we're most ashamed of.
I'm not sure that we wouldn't want to put something else a little more intelligent with these materials.
50% of human waste is E. coli bacteria. So Joe's genetically engineered a tiny image, a vaginal icon, into a strand of E. coli DNA. He calls that work Microvenus. A little piece of art to show aliens that we're more thoughtful than all that dreck might otherwise indicate. Microvenus is reproducing in a biocontainment freezer at MIT. It's ready to ship out into space, if we ever decide that's the right thing to do. And to those of you who were alarmed or offended that this artist has access and the ability to do a little genetic engineering.
Now, there are a lot of bad dreams out there, and there's a lot of evil things to do with almost anything, including genetic engineering. But see, since all of our dreams are going to come true, somebody has to have some good dreams, Lou. That's the kind of thing that America, that the whole world needs to realize.
I couldn't agree more. For Studio 360, I'm Lou Olkowski.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with Annie Drian, who was the creative director of the NASA Voyager Interstellar Record Project. That's the project that inspired the artist Joe Davis to make his own interstellar amendments that we just heard about. Annie, I presume you've heard of Joe Davis and encountered him? Or?
I'm sorry to say I haven't heard of him, but I'd like him to know that we did put full frontal nudity on the Voyager record. We had a beautiful woman and a man, and a congressional committee got wind of it and told us that we were trying to send smut into space and said that the Voyager record wouldn't be launched on the spacecraft unless we took the offending picture out of the record. So I agree with him, but I should tell him that that all of our broadcasts, the things that we're probably even more ashamed of than our fecal matter, are being sent out into space every moment, and they have been approximately since the coronation of the last King George. And so,
a fact you depict in the movie Contact.
Exactly. And so it's not that we can, any amount of Victorian self-editing that we may attempt to do, we reveal ourselves.
So what we put out in the Voyager spacecraft, what you put out in the Voyager spacecraft, is simply the official or an official version of ourselves, I guess.
It's actually the least official version of ourselves that I know of. It is the furthest object ever created by the human species. It's many billions and billions of miles from us. And the fact that it has Louis Armstrong and Blind Willie John and Chuck Berry on it, as well as Mozart and a host of 27 pieces of the world's greatest hits, I think is a kind of nice thing.
Do you regard that record, which you helped make and send out 20-some years ago, as an earnest attempt to communicate with other beings or as a symbolic gesture or somewhere in between?
It's a symbolic gesture. And the likelihood that either Voyager spacecraft will be intercepted is small. But the shelf life of both Voyager records is so long. It's 1,000,000,000 years, 1,000,000,000 years. So if you were to encounter this planet from space 1,000,000,000 years from now, you wouldn't recognize it because even the continents would have changed so dramatically. So with the notion that we could confer some kind of immortality on things that were precious to us, we sent this record out not really thinking it would necessarily be intercepted, but thinking that, you know, if the Great Wall of China is gone and the pyramids are gone and Shakespeare is gone, it'd be nice to have some rock and roll, you know, that's still playing on.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and my guest today in Studio 360 is Annie Drian, who writes about science and runs Cosmos Studios, which produces entertainment about scientific subjects. And we're talking about space. The ancient Greeks believed that music was literally the universal art, that the cosmos itself was a vast, perfectly proportioned musical instrument that produced perpetual and beautiful sounds. They called that the music of the spheres. The notion of a relationship between music and the structures in the sky hasn't disappeared, as Allison Dean explains.
The Greeks believed that the Earth was at the center of the universe, embedded in its own sphere made of a kind of hazy ether-like substance. The Earth's sphere was enclosed within a slightly larger sphere, which contained the next planet, Mars. This pattern of a sphere within a sphere continued outward with each of the remaining planets, and it was the different speeds and distances between these spheres that they thought made music. If a musician on Earth blew a few notes on a pipe, the Greeks thought those same notes were being sounded by the cosmos.
The music of the spheres is really about the most fundamental things in the universe.
Robert Saxton is a composer and professor at Oxford University who has written several pieces inspired by the idea of music of the spheres.
I think what it means to a musician today is that it's looking for some kind of divine proportion, and in the deep sense of the word, harmony.
Saxton's piece, A Yardstick to the Stars, derives from the Greek fascination with specific measurements of the sky. The music follows the way celestial bodies move at different speeds in relation to one another.
I was on holiday on a Greek island, and I was reading a book with a rather unattractive title, Mathematics in Western Culture, and there's a chapter called Placing a Yardstick to the Stars, and it mentions Hipparchus, who, B.C., before Christ, discovered trigonometry as a way of measuring planetary distance. And I suddenly realized that I was lying on a beach in Rhodes. It could, for all I know, have been the very beach that Hipparchus did his experiments on, because he drew everything in the sand with a stick. So I was rather excited by this. So when I wrote my piece, I just called it A Yardstick to the Stars, which gave the idea of different types of measurement.
Other composers aren't so interested in recreating the specific structures of the cosmos in their music. The avant-garde composer Stockhausen is still interested in the Greeks' general idea of cosmic unity. In his piece Sternklang, or Star Sound, he seduces the listener into sinking into, quote, the cosmic whole. Stockhausen believes he himself is an alien, the music supposed to prepare us for the arrival of beings from other stars.
I've been talking about Saturn for years, you see. I don't remember ever having been there, but I'm sure I'm a citizen of Saturn. But I have been to Jupiter.
The composer and band leader Sun Ra called himself a tone scientist. He delved into every dimension of musical and magical thought, from Pythagoras to the Russian mystic Madame Helena Blavatsky. But he found dissonance in space. When traditional harmony dissolved in his music, he would call that being in a space key.
The people who speak the universal language on this planet, namely musicians, they don't seem to understand anything beyond the Earth plane, except the ones I've come in contact with. Now, at first I was taught about music being a universal language. Now I'm saying that music has stepped up to be an omniversal language, you see. That's the eternal, well, the eternal everything, you might say.
These pieces by Robert Saxton, Stockhausen, and Sun Ra are frequently difficult to listen to, but they haven't got a lot more in common than that, which is perhaps strange since they're all evoking the same universe. The music of the spheres has fractured. Joe Dubiel is a professor of music at Columbia University in New York.
You can have the idea of proportion without making any reference to the planets. You don't need the planets to have something go twice as fast as something else. And the real planets don't do that anyway. Music of the spheres has something to do with claiming that your music is aligned with some larger reality, a reality that's not peculiar to Earth, but presumably goes through the entire universe.
Dubiel says people react differently when they're told a piece of music reflects the structure of the cosmos. Some people are reassured if they can plug challenging music into a larger pattern. And some listeners don't know what to say, especially if they don't like it. It's intimidating if the sound of the universe turns out to be something you hate. But, he says, when Sun Ra claimed to be from Saturn, he invited people into music that otherwise might turn them off.
Music of the spheres and music from other planets are two quite different ideas. Music from another planet is a thought that might help people to accept your music even though it sounds very strange to them. Okay? You ask them to believe that this is the music that is native to another sort of life entirely. How would the move of claiming to be from another planet help people? That move might reassure them by telling, well, you know, this music is native to somebody. There are people who are at home, or maybe they're not people, but there's someone who's at home with this.
For Studio 360, I'm Allison Dean.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the science writer and film producer Annie Drian, and we're talking about space. How does it strike you as somebody who thinks about and knows all about actual space and science when people like Stockhausen or Sun Ra talk about their music as being extraterrestrial? Do you accept that as a funny metaphor or just an artistic impulse, or do you hate it? Do you like it?
I like it. I like for people to recognize that we are part of the universe and the universe is in us. We are, after all, in the deepest sense, made of star stuff. We, the molecules and atoms in our bones, in our teeth, in our hair, were created in the hearts of distant stars. And so the more, in fact, I think the more that people invoke the cosmos, doesn't necessarily have to be rigorously scientific, but if it's inspired by the beauty of the universe, I say go, do it.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the writer and philosopher Annie Drian about space. Coming up, I'll explain the periodic table of Hollywood aliens. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest today is Anne Druyan, the co-creator with her late husband Carl Sagan of the PBS show Cosmos and the film Contact. We're looking today at our cultural fascination with space, including what we imagine might be out there. As it happens, I've actually made a small study of our pop cultural speculations about outer space, and it turns out we've got a fairly limited imagination. According to Hollywood, there are exactly 6 extraterrestrial phyla. Type 1 consists of hulking humanoids with enormous bald heads. This type originated in the 1950s. As a product of suspicious anti-intellectualism. Giant skull equals genius equals communist. Type 1s include the Klingons and the Ferengi from Star Trek.
A true Klingon rejoices at the death of his enemies. old, young, armed, unarmed. All that matters is the victory.
And the Coneheads and the exposed brain aliens in Mars Attacks. Type 2, which has emerged only during the last few decades, is the modern classic. It's the small, gray, hairless, chinless, big-eyed waif. These innocent, naked creatures began appearing during the Woodstock era, and they supplanted the sinister, aggressively superhuman aliens of the anti-communist 50s. The definitive depiction was in Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And those aliens, I think, are the cinema genetic descendants of the space fetus at the end of 2001. Hollywood Extraterrestrial Type 3 is the comic relief plush toy.
Oh, what is it? Is it alive? May I hold it?
The tiny furry Tribbles in the original Star Trek series were their first appearance. A prominent Type 3 subgroup is the evil rotund comic relief plush toy, like the creatures in Gremlins and the bovine warriors in Return of the Jedi. Type 3 aliens, silly but winning, achieved their very peak of popularity in the mid-1980s. At the same moment we were giving a landslide re-election to Ronald Reagan, our silly but winning plush toy commander-in-chief.
Wonderful. We are now a part of the tribe.
That's what I always wanted.
Type 4 is the swamp creature, reptiles and amphibians who walk upright. The nicer aliens of this type tend to be more amphibian than reptilian, like E.T. and Yoda.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No! Try not! Do! Or do not! There is no try.
Reptilian extraterrestrials are always evil, like the aliens in the Aliens movies and in Independence Day.
A creature that gestates inside a living human host. Yes. These are your words. And has concentrated acid for blood.
That's right.
Hollywood Extraterrestrial Type 5 consists of hypertrophied arthropods, or, in layman's terms, really, really big shellfish and insects. Like with the reptilian aliens they sometimes resemble, the morphology seems clear. Bugs are gross, and so insect-like aliens are evil, whether it's in Men in Black or Starship Troopers.
You're under arrest for violating sections 4153 of the Tycho Treaty.
So hand over whatever galaxy you might be carrying and step away from your busted-ass vehicle and put your hands on your head.
And Type 6, more or less normal-looking people, includes most aliens in episodic network television, from the original Star Trek to the Third Rock from the Sun. Lots of times in TV shows and movies, aliens only temporarily assume human form, like in the Jodie Foster movie Contact, in order to charm Earthlings, or to keep production costs down.
You're not real. None of this is real.
That's my scientist.
When I was unconscious, you downloaded my thoughts, my memories, even physical.
Even in Men in Black and the forthcoming Men in Black 2, the film's executive producer, Walter Parks, told me that his co-executive producer, Steven Spielberg, insisted that the alien faces had to embody human structure. I asked Parks why, and he said, because, of course, Steven Spielberg is an alien himself. I'm pretty sure he was joking. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with Annie Druyan about space and art and entertainment. You helped make the wonderful film Contact, in which the one alien we saw didn't look like an alien at all. He was Jodie Foster's father, or at least that was the form he or she took. Why did you make that choice?
Well, first of all, because we recognized our impoverishment of imagination when it comes to imagining the aliens. We had the same exact response that you had to them, that they are predictable, and that if we ever do come across another form of life in the cosmos, I think the astonishment will be that it's nothing like what we imagined. I mean, could you imagine a snail or a seahorse? There are so many forms of life on Earth that are so astonishing that it just makes you realize that the language of life is probably has so many more idioms than we can even imagine. So recognizing that, but also it worked for us on another level, which was that on a spiritual level, Jodie Foster was a skeptic who went out into the universe and found the person she loved most and who was now dead. And so it had a kind of emotional resonance, but it was mostly an admission that we have no business imagining those aliens until we know more about life in the universe.
And when they're depicted more abstractly as beams of light or bursts of energy, there's something disappointing about that.
It's not satisfying. And the other thing is that, as you pointed out, our imaginings of the alien have a very brief shelf life. 2001 still, to me, has a kind of modern feel to it. It seems more modern than so many of the movies made since. Simply,
and we're dressing like that now.
Exactly.
I mean,
yes.
Just on the banal level.
Right, exactly. I mean, the set design on that movie was really spectacular. And there's a kind of optimism about the future that you feel in that movie. That was, what, 1967 or 8, which I don't think we've really felt since. And that's another thing that you see in movies about the universe mostly is a kind of, because they are projections, there's a sense that that we're hopelessly outnumbered and outwitted, and that there's really, that all the universe holds for us is hideous death and dread.
Does it bug you as a person familiar with science and who cares about science and the scientific understanding when science fiction gets too fictional and diverges too radically from real life?
I don't mind flights of fantasy. I just don't like it when they get the science wrong. I could never understand why you spend $120 million on a movie and you can't fork over a couple of thou to a grad student somewhere who would give anything to have the privilege of telling you whether or not the science and the script is right. That really offends me.
In the last few years, in the very last few years, between the Hubble Space Telescope and cosmological speculations, we've really advanced our knowledge of how space is structured. Is that, do you think, going to affect the way storytellers and filmmakers and artists are inspired by ideas about space?
I sure hope so, because I think that disconnect between what we know and what we feel is reaching a kind of crisis stage in our civilization. And that it would be wonderful for us to get our brains and our hearts and our eyes working in some kind of concert so that we could feel something deeply without having to lie to ourselves. And I think that's really what art is about. If it's art is bereft of any kind of reality, then it's, you know, it's good because it tells you, you know, what was going on at that moment. But beyond that, it's unlikely to have that kind of transcendental quality.
Well, you say feel something deeply without having to lie to ourselves, which reveals your secular humanist point of view, which I share. But on the other hand, I think we want to know the scientific facts and yet not have that be a cold, soulless, mechanistic understanding of existence.
Quite right. And that's the way that the scientific community has failed. And this is a kind of a longstanding failure on the part of science, which Carl Sagan, I think, did more than anyone I've ever heard of to try to correct. But I think it's, you know, while there are many, many people, if my anecdotal experience is indicative of anything, there are so many people who are attracted to science because of something Carl did. And I think that when they come of age, they're likely to be more forthright about what they feel and less constrained and less uptight and more likely to communicate not just the facts, but the grandeur that those facts suggest to us.
If NASA called you tomorrow and said, Anne, we'd like you to send you up to the space station, would you go?
No. I'm a mother, And so I'm bound to this Earth. I'm both a mother and a daughter, and so I couldn't possibly leave.
And what if NASA called you up and said, or what if your child said, Mom, I'm going to go on the next shuttle flight to the International Space Station?
My children are free to wander the universe. That's my gift to them.
Annie, I want to thank you so much for joining me in Studio 360 today.
My pleasure.
Annie Drian served for a decade as Secretary of the Federation of American Scientists. She was also creative director of the NASA Voyager Interstellar Record. You can find out more about Annie Drian and see a slideshow of images from every story on today's show on our website, studio360.org. Some people dream about traveling into space, and some people, we call them astronauts, actually get to do that. And some people dream about owning any little thing that once belonged to any person who's been in space. To close our show today, George Meyer, who's an executive producer of The Simpsons, told us about his collection of space memorabilia.
Space memorabilia is an odd phrase. To me, the space program still seems futuristic. 40 years after the first manned flight, and 34 years after Don Knotts starred in The Reluctant Astronaut.
First aid separating.
As a kid, this film inspired me. If bureaucratic errors could send a bumbling custodian into orbit, there was hope for a preteen from Arizona.
Hello! Hello down there! She broke! She broke! I found a big hunk! Follow up!
Take it easy, Roy. Take it easy.
But life had other plans for me, so now I content myself with mementos of space travel. My first collectibles were signed photos of Yuri Gagarin, the first human in space. He's been described as an uncomplicated man with a fondness for good times and women. I have a shot of him at the beach with his arm around two girls. There's also a picture of Gagarin with Fidel Castro. The two appear tipsy, and they're wearing each other's hats. Then there's my darling, darling Valentina Tereshkova. In her enormous, clunky helmet, the first woman in space looks sturdy and sweet, with a captivating lunch lady face. Valentina, for that is what I call her, orbited the Earth 48 times, then got hitched to a fellow cosmonaut, Nikolaev. Do I resent him? No. Do I have her signed wedding photo? You know I do. It warms me to think that this cherub-cheeked cutie is out there right now, living her Russian life. Moscow is unloading some fascinating treasures these days. Hanging in my kitchen is the hatch cover from Soyuz 3. In English and in Russian, it reads, "Help! Man inside!" An arrow points to the hatch key. The idea was if the capsule were to land in a wheat field, the startled farmer could twist it open like a sardine can. But it's not all cosmonauts. I also dig NASA's cool cat, Alan Shepard, who hit golf balls on the moon. He secretly practiced his swing after work wearing the full suit with oxygen tanks. The ultimate prize, the actual six iron he used, is at the USGA Museum in Far Hills, New Jersey. I plan to steal it in an Ocean's 11-style heist.
Gentlemen, I'd like you to meet the two experienced astronauts who will accompany the winner into space. Grace Banion and Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon.
Second comes right after first.
Buzz Aldrin is another favorite, especially since he played himself on The Simpsons.
Mission Control, this is Corbett. Launch sequence initiated. All systems go.
Are we there yet? I'm thirsty.
So many of Colonel Aldrin's personal doodads come up for sale that I picture a very clean garage. You can buy his key to the city of Odessa, Texas, a check he wrote to the DMV, and his jacket from Planet Hollywood. The man is not clinging to the past. There's a magic word in space collecting, and that word is flown. Anything that was actually flown on a mission gets people revved up. A flown chess set, flown apricot pudding, a flown green plastic mermaid. Gordon Cooper flew into orbit wearing a yarmulke, or as the auction catalog helpfully adds, a Jewish skullcap. The first time I got my mitts on a flown item, a Soviet-stamped envelope, I gazed at it expectantly, waiting for it to dazzle me somehow, or perhaps even open up some kind of portal to another dimension. The envelope had traveled vast distances and been bombarded with who knows how many cosmic rays and astro particles. Yet it just sat there. Much of my collection just sits there. I have a little hunk of Skylab that landed in Australia. I have tiny squares of foil from Apollos 11, 13, and 14. And one huge thing, a control panel from a Soyuz TM series spacecraft. It features a twirling globe dealie that shows you what part of the Earth you're flying over. It doesn't work, though. It just sits there. A few years ago, I got outbid on a killer item, a dog spacesuit. Since then, my girlfriend Maria keeps mentioning how cool the dog spacesuit was. The thing is, I know it was cool. The next time she brings it up, I'm going to say, look, just let it go, okay? My latest obsession is rocket mail. In the 1930s, people thought it would be neat to deliver letters by missile. These pointy-nosed mailmen would often go haywire, starting fires or plunging into a lake. Very little rocket mail survives today, but since almost no one wants it, there's plenty to go around. One major collector was the ad man who created Snap, Crackle, and Pop. I just thought you should know. Space collecting is a strange hobby. I can't really explain why I paid good money for some old lighters that belonged to astronaut Dick Gordon. On the other hand, my friend Dave collects props from Star Wars. He gets all worked up over some fake helmet from a fictional movie. I mean, that's just nuts.
George Meyer writes for the television program The Simpsons. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Andy Lancet,
Amy Jeffries,
Lou Olkowski.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life. Additional funding comes from this and other PRI stations nationwide.
PRI. Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
We all have logged a lot of time looking at ourselves in the mirror and looking at our loved ones and people that we care about.
Chuck Close explains why he makes his friends' faces 9 feet tall.
There's an entrance into the work through a life experience as well as an art experience.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me in Studio 360, where art and real life collide, from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.